What is the basic premise of the Tsimbali fallacy? And am I saying it right?
The Tsimbali fallacy is how you say it. And the basic premise is that there are many, many things that are hidden from us by our culture, by our upbringing, by our socialization. And we don't know about them. They're invisible to us. However, they're still there and they still have power. And they're represented by the Neanderthal and also by the old ranching methods, which many people don't recognize.
So the Neanderthal live among us in this book. How do they manage to stay hidden in the 21st century?
They couldn't if they didn't have special talents and skills. Neanderthal kin fur. That's their basic and strongest skill. And that means that if a Neanderthal touches someone, including a mammal or a bird, they can experience what that other is experiencing in some cases.
And what, let's just go ahead and define clashing and cloven.
Being cloven. Yes, new words. Following the strict grammatical problems of English. Clashing is when you are able to release your experience and your feelings to some other who is furring you. Being cloven is when you close so that they cannot. It's the same as opening or closing your eyes or hiding from someone. So if you are trying not to be seen, you kind of disappear yourself within a room full of people.
So in this book, you have a lot of main characters.
Oh, yeah.
And they range in age from 2.5 to old beyond counting.
Mm-hmm.
Did you set out to tackle such a huge cast of characters?
No, I did not, but they just came along. And so they were there. They came in from the horizon, and they were needed to tell the story. In fact, as I was telling the story, I tried to cut some of the characters out because it was getting so huge. But I couldn't. They're all important.
Yeah, okay. The book explores complex and wonderfully rendered family dynamics, revealing a lot of depth of human understanding. To what extent does that reflect the structure and dynamics of your own family?
Lots of people look at this who know my family and think I'm talking about individuals in my family, which I'm not. I think every person in every family has certain feelings and values, and it reflects aspects of my family members, but not any particular family member.
Would you say there's anything remotely like furring or lashing that you experience or are aware of in your own life?
Not in the sense of the physical aspect of it, not that sense. But I do think that some people are far more sensitive to what other people are undergoing than other people are sensitive to it. I think there are some people who understand what is happening and what these other people around them are experiencing.
So furring is kind of like empathic to the nth degree.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, except you're right in there. And I think the idea of touching, I felt that it was very important to convey the idea both metaphorically and actual physically, that touching other people is important, and very often we don't. And I don't mean like Aunt Tilda hugs you all the time till you want to run away, but I mean the fact that you don't feel put off by someone because of characteristics that they may have.
There are so many wonderful gems of passages in here, both describing Western Colorado, where much of this story takes place. You had one passage about the clouds and their hips and their hairdos. It still brings chills to my arms. It's just beautiful writing about Western Colorado. And wonderful perceptive stuff about human emotions and depth of character. Why did you choose to use ranching as such a key component? I mean, the ranch is almost a character in itself, and a symbol in this novel.
That's a difficult question. On the simple level of it, it's because I know this, and this is my background, and this is my life. But more importantly, I think that ranching represents a connection to the world that people need to explore, a connection in which the ecosystem is simultaneously used, and if it's correctly done, it's appreciated. And I think that it's at that level that we can make a good outcome for what we want to do with our world.
Mm-hmm. You incorporate mythologies from across the globe. How did you choose which mythologies to use in the book?
Horrifyingly enough, I have to tell you, they introduced themselves. The book has a flow to it. It starts out on purpose. It starts out with the idea of the very literal. The sun is going around the earth. It's the really empirical, here's what I see kind of thing. And injected in that is the problem of the Neanderthal. Then it moves on to soft science, and here's what soft science does with this world. Then it starts to creep into American myth, and finally it goes into some universal myths. And there were things that came to me, and there they were. And so we needed to put them in the right place. An example is Kuan Yin. And I love Kuan Yin. She is Chinese. And she had a terrible life. And her father finally slaughtered her and sent her to hell. And she was such a wonderful person that she turned hell into paradise. And so they had to send her away from hell. And she inserts herself into this book.
I have a lot of questions about how you wrote it. And, well, first of all, how do you pronounce Sumbalain.
Yes.
And that means?
It means symbolizing. And it's a real word.
A figure.
It's from the Greek. And it has connotations of throwing, and the idea that a word is something that you throw out into the world became a very strong metaphor for me. And it refers to the symbolizing that we do as we take reality and turn it into our own reality.
And that's one of the primary differences between the Sumbali or the Sumbalain and the Neanderthals, is that their primary way of knowing is this logos, this way of knowing through words and symbols, as opposed to through feelings and experience,
and experiential. Yes, and back to the touching and inferring. The thing is that the Neanderthals, who call themselves human, can symbolize and experience the world at that level, whereas the Sumbalis have no idea that this other world is occurring just right there.
Among them. And so the Neanderthals are black, they're white, they're Jewish, they're Christian, they are integrated throughout all of the rest of the, what we call human species. Mm-hmm. I felt when I finished it that it was all about unity. And that surprised you. Why?
Well, it follows a pattern. It's about the cycles of reality. So unity being one part of the cycle. At the first part, you have separation, which symbolizes the entire separation of the universe to create from nothing something. The separation of something from nothing, and you have Kevin and Kit separating. And then you have conflict, which symbolizes all of this conflict that goes on. I mean, when I write about conflict, I'm thinking about planets crashing into each other. And then you have blindness, and then you have death. And so with death you begin. But with total unity, you've got nothing. So you have to separate out and discover what kinds of diversity you might have and what you can do with it.
Now, the book starts with a conflict between Kit, who is Neanderthal, and Kevin, who is Cymbali. They're married. Mm-hmm. They fell in love. Kit knew that they were two different sort of subspecies of human. Mm-hmm. Kevin knows nothing about it. And part of the tension in the book is Kevin's gradual discovery that there's something very deeply different between him and his wife. Mm-hmm. And their children, one is predominantly got the Neanderthal or the human characteristics of furring and mm-hmm. the language. Mm-hmm. And the other, Tyler, doesn't at first. And mm-hmm. the tension goes from this small family dynamic into a sudden global dynamic of difference between the Neanderthal and the Cymbali.
One of the themes that works its way along through the book is Tyler's search for identity. She doesn't know who she is, and she's getting no help from anyone because she seems to be a Cymbali. Her father is Cymbali, and she feels she has no idea that her mother is a Neanderthal because the Neanderthal reject her. They're afraid of the fact that she is half and half and doesn't seem to have any of the abilities to fur or to be part of them. And so she's very rejected, ignored, and has to find her way in the world and find out who she is.
Yeah,
and come to terms with that. Yeah, mm-hmm. She's very marginal.
So what are some of the visual characteristics that define the Neanderthal, and why don't the Cymbali figure it out in the last 28,000 years?
Because, first of all, of course, they are making an effort not to be seen, but it's not so blatant. We have a stereotype of what a Neanderthal looks like. We have a stereotype. Based on the news recently, we have profiling that we do for races. Most of what we do with ethnicity and race is a cultural construct, and because the Neanderthal are not known, we're not out looking for it. We're oblivious.
It's their ability to sort of hide in plain sight because nobody knows they're there mm-hmm. that keeps them safe for 28,000 years. And suddenly, it's a big taboo for the Neanderthal to reveal to anyone else. But suddenly, in this one family, a whole bunch of them start revealing because mm-hmm. of situations. Mm-hmm. And then the tension builds, and there is a, you know, the last volume is very sort of edge of your seat, exciting about how the awareness mm-hmm. comes to mm-hmm. first this small area and then this larger area that there are these two kinds of people. In the process of writing fiction, how do you make stuff up? I mean, talk a little bit about the writing process in general, and in specific, how do you fabricate fiction?
Someone else asked me that. They said, where did that come from? It's there. It's just there. I'm a person who has always done the daydreaming kind of thing. And so if I am out in the pasture where Rocky was, he's with me. When I'm going over the passes with Tyler or Kit and Kevin, I'm doing it in real life. It's there. They're there. It's like being haunted.